from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Jacob, what's up, man?
How's it going, Graydon?
Pretty good. Just putting you on the fat monitor over here. Well, let me introduce you to my my audience on Ustream. I'm speaking with Jacob. How do I pronounce your last name?
Fortan.
Fortan. Okay, Jacob Fortan of the Good Atheist Podcast. And he's been gracious enough to allow me to take place and have a spot on this podcast. So we just want to show our appreciation. Thank you.
It's weird because I feel like I'm on the other end here. I am like the guest host because you've been doing this apparently as of now for 3 hours waiting because we had a kind of like the conflict between East and West time zones.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that I just moved time zones too. So, you know, it's like...
Where are you right now?
I went from L.A. back to the Phoenix area to finish up my album. And so basically, you know, coming back here, I think I lost an hour or something like that. And so, like, I was already still trying to get used to the time and end up, you know, kind of here 3 hours early. And I'm talking to my people and we're here talking about hip hop. And I'm like, I hope I got the time right. Everybody's like, are you still doing this interview? I'm like, I don't know. And then I looked and it said Eastern Standard Time, which I assumed that it was, you know, I had confused. I just got it.
I haven't quite decided when trying to arrange interviews what time frame to use. Like, I'm actually rather sick of it. I wish we could just all move to, like, star dates or something. You know what I mean? Like, we just all have the same date. I don't care what fucking time of day it is. I'll just...
The only place that's ever going to happen is in space.
Yeah. Well, you need a better clock in space to try to measure time than how many times a fucking ball of rock is circling the sun. Be like, I don't know. What happens when it gets eaten up and there's nothing but a fucking white dwarf and a cloudy nebula left? Be like, what the time zone then?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we all know that it's man-made. We know that this is man's way of trying to understand the world around him. And, you know, this is... Why we all have such a gross misunderstanding about the world around us, because we use such limited descriptions of the world and the universe around us. So, you know, and then we have to communicate it with words vocally, and then everyone doesn't speak the same language and things get lost in translation. Even then, it's, you know, it's hard to try to depict or try to tell people what really is, give a good description of nature, you know, when we all have our own definitions. You know, when I say the word nature, you may think something different. When I say the word God, you may think something different, or spirit or soul, you think something completely different. And we have to get through those translations in real time for me to try to explain to you what I'm trying to say.
Are you trying? I feel like you're totally reversing me. I am so weirded out because I got to tell you, I'm used to being the host. You're doing such a good job. I'm like, maybe you should, I just should just hand over the podcast to you and you can just do my job. Yeah.
I have fun doing this because we hang out on Ustream all the time and, you know, we play chess, we watch videos. We just got finished, you know, watching, I'm not going to name the show, but we just got finished watching our favorite political show on Ustream with a bunch of us and stuff to get ready for this. And so, you know, it was fun. And so we do this all the time. So whenever you want to do this, you hit me up and I'm always willing to come back.
Okay. Well, I got to ask you first question, is what is the level of, let's say, controversy that we can talk about? Because there's a bunch of subjects, specifically because I've been following you for a while, and there's a couple of songs of yours that I want to talk about. Specifically, I think your song N-Word. And
that's
that will just...
Controversial song? Really?
Yeah, not just controversial, but because of what will be coming out of my mouth if we talk about it. And I know...
We understand the nature of the song and what we're talking about, so I think we're all safe here.
Right. Well, I only say this because there is a tendency for certain people to let certain chat programs or whatever just run in the background while they're doing something like work-related. And for me, everybody who downloads my show knows what to expect. I think probably within the first 2 minutes, as soon as I open my mouth and start saying swear words. So I'm lucky that way. But, you know, I don't know how you generally sort of like handle the podcast version of
honestly,
it.
I've never, there's nothing off limits for me. I mean, honestly, I've had I've made some very questionable decisions throughout my life. I've made some horrible, horrible mistakes in my life that, you know, if I could do it over again, obviously I would change it. You know, if anybody, you know, has ever felt wronged by any of my controversy or things that has come as a result of my baggage, you know, obviously I want to extend my apologies to them. But, you know, like I said, my life is an open book for the most part, because if it doesn't come out in an interview, it's going to come out in my music some way, just the same way we're talking about the N-word song now.
Right.
So, I mean, that's how I felt when I wrote the song. I mean, I don't completely feel the exact same way now. I mean, I feel about 80% of that is still the same, but I've altered and developed certain ideas that I had during that song a little bit with my experience that I've gained since I wrote the song. Remember, I was only 24, 25 when I wrote the song. So, I mean, you know, I can only know so much about my environment and how I'm trying to depict and make my argument based on a 24 or 25 year old's experience.
Well, that's a good way of putting it, because, you know, I think that every once in a while, anybody who's, you know, the internet doesn't forget. And not just that, but it doesn't forget in a weird way, where every once in a while, you know, a post that I will have written 4 years ago will just sort of like pop back up, and somebody will be like, ah, your opinion is wrong on that. And, you know, in a weird way, I'm like, I kind of agree. Because 4 years ago, I mean, what was I writing? I don't even fucking remember what I was like 4 years ago.
In a completely different state.
Exactly. Totally different state. And I guess that's probably some of the reasons why I want to talk about some of your older work and your newer work. But the first thing I want to talk about is actually the title of your album. Because it's more than just a title. It sort of speaks to the general feeling of the work, is the best way I can say. Because when I listen to it, how's it pronounced? The Kardashev?
The Kardashev scale.
Kardashev, okay, thank you. The Kardashev scale. And when I was listening to it, I felt like there's a really strong kind of like ambient, almost cosmic kind of perspective. Like I really felt there was I don't know, it's very transcendent. And some of the subject matter, we'll talk about the first song I want to mention, is called Star View. And in it, you asked this interesting question. I was hoping maybe you could elaborate, because perhaps your thoughts have changed, that in the song you mentioned, if you had a pill that could make you live for 900 years, what would you do with it? And my question is, what would you do with it now?
First, I appreciate your appreciation of the song. I guess where I think I was going with that was, to answer your question directly, would I take the pill? If it's 900 years, of course I would. 900 years is not a long time in the cosmic scheme of things, since we're talking about it on such a scale. Of course I would take it. I would take it just short of, you know, living forever, because I feel like, you know, living forever would be the tipping point, would be, you know, obviously I don't want to be on a road that just keeps going and there's just nothing. And I've seen and experienced everything, but I can't escape my existence. That would be some sort of a hell for me. But if I knew that I could end my existence at any time, let's say just short of a universe that I can't escape through my technology or whatever, then okay, I'm cool with that. But as long as I have ultimate control over my circumstances, is what I was really arguing. If the pill allowed me to dictate my circumstances, then I would take the pill, because the pill gives me control.
Well, but it control, I mean, in a sense, you could still get hit by a bus. I mean, you took a pill.
That's true. Right? And that's something that you would have to factor into that. You would have to say, okay, I'm going to still do my regimen. I'm going to still keep my health up. I'm going to still exercise. I'm going to still take my Methuselah pill, but I'm also going to be wary that other things can be a threat to me. Other things can kill me. I could be, you know, like you said, hit by a bus or die in a plane crash or something like that. But some of the things that I normally would have to worry about, you know, as far as certain cancers or certain viruses or anything like that, those things would obviously be cured or inhibited by this pill. and we'll call it
the Methuselah pill. Yeah, which is unfortunately in the future is extremely large and a suppository. So
it's a suppository. Of course it is, because nothing that good you'd ever just be able to swallow.
It's never that easy, right? You got to make it a little bit hard. Look, if it was easy, then everybody would do it. It's got to be painful. It's got to be embarrassing.
Yeah, uncomfortable, right. And everyone has to know, like, you've been here for 900 years. You knew how you got here.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's embarrassed. Like, tell us the secret, elders. I don't think so. No.
Yeah. You don't need to know. You're better seen, not heard.
There's another song I wanted to talk about, because I know that you you are a veteran of the Iraq War, and you have written about it in one of your songs, War Porn, and specifically in the song you seem to try to make this message that the secret elements of war are really what we should be frightened of. Like, is that based on personal experience during the war? Did you notice a lot of things happening behind the scenes? Is that what freaked you out about the whole process?
I mean, I can only tell it from my perspective and my vantage, but I always felt that the whole process was ultimately just chaotic. It was just, you know, nothing, everything that was planned, nothing that was ever planned ever went according to plan. As soon as you drive out of the gates or wherever you're going, you know, it's like plans break down and you gotta improvise. And I felt like the entire ordeal that I experienced was just, you know, very chaotic and, you know, a clusterfuck. You know, like with the units that I was there with, one of the units I didn't feel like I should have been there with, but, you know, whatever. I felt like I was trying to depict in that particular song that while you're trying to deal with the what's going on in your head, with you trying to understand why you're even here, you still have to be able to keep your wits about you, keep your hyper awareness, be able to communicate with your battle buddies.
Be in combat mode, basically.
Right, exactly. And it's like you got to factor that with, well, I haven't gotten any mail. You got to deal with the fact that your battle buddy hasn't heard from his wife in 2 weeks and he's worried that she's messing around. So he's not focused on covering your ass. So now you got to talk to him more about what's going on with his wife. Oh, don't worry about it, man. It's all right. She's busy right now, man. What if they hit the mail truck or whatever? You know, you're just trying to tell this dude, you know, yo, keep your mind focused on the task. And obviously I had the same issues. You know, I was 19, 20 years old. So it was like, I wasn't hyper aware all the time. I wasn't focused all the time. I had my own issues and my own stuff I was dealing with coming out of the system of California. So all of that baggage, all of that crap, and then you put me in a combat experience, you put me in theater, then what?
would you say based on your background, because I mean it sounds, I mean I only have the Wikipedia definition of it, and obviously the let's just say the youthful rage from your music, but I mean can you give me a bit of an idea of how, you know, you growing up, like, were you a very angry young man when you went into the army? Was the experiences, did they sort of like contribute to more confusion or more anger? Like, how did you get out of it? And was that music kind of a way for you to deal with that?
Well, let me answer the first question first. Was there anger? And I would say yes, but I didn't understand the source of the anger. You have to understand my circumstances. I was a product of a 14-year-old mother in the 80s, which comes with a lot of stuff. I grew up in, you know, LA in the 90s in my adolescence, which comes with a whole bunch of gang baggage. When I grew up in the system in abusive foster and group homes. I was abused as a child. It's no secret. I don't hide my physical or, you know, other types of abuse that I endured growing up. And, you know, I carried all of that baggage into the military. And there were 100, 200 other new recruits that had their own individual separate baggage and that we all had to coexist together. My anger came from the fact that I knew very little about what I wanted to know, and that was about myself. You know, my father was a gang member who was killed, you know, early in his life. I wasn't aware of my mother's existence until I was 14 years old. The one biological sister that I had, I was separated from when, you know, I was 11 or 12 or something. I think I was younger than that. I think it was like 10. So for me, I had more questions than I had answers. And when you don't get those answers and you just get shoved into a bunch of new questions, completely alien questions. You know, I had LA gang references. I didn't have United States combat theater references. And to go from one quickly to another over a year and a half period, to grow up in that situation, because I wasn't grown. I still wasn't grown up at all.
Right.
I was still a child. So I'm still taking these experiences and this baggage into theater. So like I said, now you have all that other stuff, all that other baggage, and that's kind of where I came from.
Compounded by, like you said before, everyone else's, and really, like, I guess you saw the direct advantage of taking part in people's issues. Like, if I don't deal with it, I'm a fucking dead man.
Yeah, I mean, but it was also for me, I knew that if I didn't leave LA, you know, I was either going to get caught up in some gang shit, or, you know, I was going to just, you know, because that anger manifested itself when I was younger. I fought a lot. You know, I was a very aggressive, you know, problems things I still struggle with today. You know, I had to be that way because of survival. It wasn't that I chose to be that way. It was that if you're in 30 different group homes in 19 years and, you know, 80% of those group homes, when you walk in, the first question some kid asks you is, what gang you from? You develop a survival instinct real quick. It's not, hey, what's going on in your life? Come sit down on this bed. Let's talk about it. You know, it's, I don't like those blue, you know, jeans and those blue sneakers you got on. You know, you're out here in Pomona. That shit don't fly. You know, and so you gotta kind of develop that quickly. And when you get stunted in growth because you go from one situation to the next, you know, you take all that baggage with you. And that was kind of what that was kind of the baggage that I had going into the military.
How did you start really beginning to express yourself creatively? Like, how long have you been involved in music, and where did this start? I mean, it sounds like in this chaotic world, like, where are you finding time for music?
Well, you know, there was a group home that I was in that had, it was a big facility, housed some like 300, 400 kids. And this is one of the earlier group homes that I was in. I was about eight or nine years old. And basically there was a gym that they had that had a piano inside, and I would basically break out of the housing unit that I was in, break into the gym and play the piano at night, and then sneak back into my room. And like, I got caught obviously at one time. I think I maybe did it like 4 or 5 times, and I got busted and it never happened again. But that was when it started, you know, around that time. And then when I left that group home, I was able to experiment with other types of music. I think I didn't start writing lyrics until I was about 17, but I always played the piano. I always played the keyboard. I would always gravitate towards the keys wherever they were. I remember my brother, when we lived in the projects, you know, he had this old keyboard, and, you know, he gave me this old keyboard, and that was the keyboard that I used. I would go through the projects through gang-infested territory where people would see me and just be like, yo, we coming after you right now just for this dirty Casio keyboard that today I wouldn't look at twice.
Well, you know, I did notice quite a bit of piano. I was going to mention it in Stockholm Syndrome, Proof of Concept. You seem to really just overlay your lyrics with that piano. I was going to say, like, is that your instrument? Like, ultimately, your sort of like your passion is a piano?
Yes, absolutely. But to be fair, Stockholm Syndrome is a sample. Proof of Concept I did play myself, but Stockholm Syndrome is a sample.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but no, I am a piano player. That was the first instrument before my voice. You know, it's ultimately what I love, and you know, yeah, that's my instrument. If I had to make a choice right now, it'd be the piano.
Well, I mean, I can only imagine. You know, there's something. I don't know if we're just drawn to it, but when something is forbidden almost, we always seem a little bit more attracted to it. It's kind of the story of Romeo and Juliet. You know, we almost we cherish this love when all it was forbidden love. So that fruit was enough to kind of keep us hooked. And I have to wonder if perhaps that was part of that, you know, what ignited you. I mean, imagine the sheer pleasure, just always on that edge of danger and finding out new things. I mean, it must have really been a pretty wild experience. Do you kind of like feel those days? I mean, it probably doesn't have a lot of nostalgia, but I'm guessing that even playing is going to bring up a lot of painful memories at the same time, no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but it's escapism. You know, with my music, it's always been that way. I've used it to escape and try to understand. I tried to use it as a tool to understand my existence, why things were happening to me that were happening to me, why I kept finding myself in these you know, really tough circumstances. And I'm not trying to say, hey, woe is me, I had the absolute worst circumstances. But from my vantage point at the time, I didn't have much to lean on, and music was there. So, you know, these days I'm so protective of music and how much time I have to make it and the interruptions that I have and that sort of thing. And when things conflict with that, you know, those things go bye-bye. And it's not personal. It's just, I've built that survival, that defense mechanism has basically been, you know, burned in to my mind. And that's what I needed at the time. And I guess what I continue to need today to function. If I don't have music, you know, put me down, I don't need to be here.
Do you think that there's, like in your own life, like you mentioned sort of like, you know, the violence of the gangs, and then later sort of like, you know, the violence in, you were in Iraq or were you in Afghanistan?
Oh, I was in Iraq.
You're in Iraq.
I have friends who are in Afghanistan who still deal with Afghanistan. If you guys are listening to this, be safe.
There's probably some people who do listen. You know, I know for a fact that there is a whole troop apparently that listens to the show while they're patrolling. I always think about them.
Let me take the time right now to thank every one of those people for their service. Like I was walking through the mall the other day and I saw a veteran, and I don't think this happens enough, but I do it every time I see it because I would hope that someone would do it for me had they known that my service. You know, I saw this guy and he had his veteran hat on, had his unit on, and I walked up to him. I said, you know, hey, sir, are you a veteran? He said, yeah, I am. I said, I just want to thank you for your service. And, you know, he acted like that was the first time that had ever happened. Why is it that I could see Blake Griffin and walk up to him and ask him for his autograph and be like, oh, I'm so enamored at what you do, but I can't see this veteran and be like, yo, I'm enamored by what you do.
Maybe it's just because we kind of feel embarrassed. I mean, think about the fact that you have one side that tries to use veterans in combat as a political tool. Say the right tends to do this. And on the left, when you're dealing with the fact that no one's really taking care of these people. You know, when they come back, they have injuries where you're just like, they're forgotten because no one really wants to deal, it seems, with the realities of war on either side. Like, who's left to really sweep up, like, the crumbled lives that are fucking left behind?
I think one of the more untalked about things about combat vets when they reenter society is how we don't take into account what that means when they reenter the workforce or try to reenter the workforce. Like, you know, I know people who, after four tours, you're going to try to put them in an office. You know, you're going to try to put them in a mail room. You're going to try to put them in a warehouse stacking boxes. You know, like something, there's something there that's not going to allow them to be completely satisfied with what they're doing because something that they did prior has so much, I mean, I'm not going to say value, but it made so much of a difference. You know, whatever happened to me, it was going to make a difference in somebody's life, my life, their life.
So what you're saying is, how are they supposed to deal with the fact that life has kind of been tuned down, like to a two when they were used to being at an eight?
And then how you have to deal with issues in the real world as opposed to the military, which isn't the real world.
It's like prison. They just set everything for you. You know?
Say prison because I've been locked up and it's not prison.
Okay, well,
but it is something that takes a certain level of, you have to give up a lot of your free will. Your own kind of direction and drive a lot of times takes a backseat to how they want to use you. Well, you know, so my music wasn't important to anybody but me in the military.
Well, what do you think is I mean, obviously, from the fact that you were part of the military, you obviously saw that, you know, what would you obviously saw the good and the bad being from there. What would you say, at least for you, is the thing that you left and said, like, I appreciate that experience just for, like, you know, this part is mm-hmm. still special to me. You know, like, what would that be?
From the military?
Yeah. Is there anything?
Oh, the camaraderie, the people, man. Like, I met, you know, some of the best friends I'll ever meet in my life. Like, you know, my brother Jeff, we were battle buddies. Like, you know, when you serve with somebody and you wear that uniform with them and you feel like it's just you two against the world. Like, when I grew up, I was a big wrestling fan. My older brother was a wrestling fan, so we watched a lot of wrestling. And I had a big idea about tag team partners.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so yeah. I hear you.
When I left my big brother, I went and had to go find a new tag team partner. I was running solo. And I found my other brother, Jeff, in the military. And, you know, it's like when you meet somebody, you just instantly know, like you just click. And it was kind of like that with me and him. And you kind of have those experiences throughout your four-year period in the military. And so I met, you know, a few very exceptional people in my time. And I believe that there were many, many more exceptional people in the military that I didn't have the opportunity to meet because of how the military was either using them or, you know, just the circumstances that we had. So, I mean, that was the thing I remember the most, man. Being in the barracks, practical jokes, having, like, you know, super
guy fights. Guy time.
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, there were chicks involved too, and then they played just as hard as the dudes. So, you know, those were good times, man. We were young, we were naive. You know, we hadn't experienced anything in theater. 9/11 really hadn't even happened yet. You know, we were still in training and shit. And so, you know, you just kind of have that. Okay, I'm going to the military to go to school. Nothing there, because who's gonna attack America?
No one.
Remember when you used to think that?
Yeah, but it's funny that we thought that because it was happening all the time. I mean, I don't think that most people really fully appreciate the fact that the 1993 bombings came very close to meeting their objectives.
Really?
Yeah, like a lot of people don't realize just how much of a chunk they ripped out, and had they planned better, like one of the buildings may have like fallen over and knocked the other one down. It could have happened.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's crazy.
Well, you know, it's just, it's kind of like, what are you going to do? Are you going to really tell people how close it came? Maybe, you know, in hindsight, you probably should have, but.
You never get the full truth at first.
No, that's true. And plus, you also have to wonder, I mean, like, there'll always be different opinions about the specifics, you know, like if I read an article saying, yes, they did a lot more damage. Somebody else could just as well say, well, no, I'm an expert, and of course they didn't. Is my information 100% correct? I can't guarantee it, really.
That's true.
Now, there's something else I wanted to mention in terms of your books. Not your books, sorry, your music. There's one.
I got books out?
Yeah, you got books, man. Don't you know someone has been transcribing your lyrics and selling the books there? But your song, Proof of Concept, Is it a defense of nerdcore? Is this sort of you coming out and saying, I don't care if I lose fans, but I defend nerdism?
I defend the provocation of thought. You know, I don't think right now we're in a culture where it's cool to be dumb. And, you know, right now intellectualism is kind of looked at as being snobby, or you're not letting people have their own opinions. Look, I'm challenging bullshit. All right. If I'm on some bullshit, I would expect you to challenge me. And if we were to challenge more of each other's BS, maybe the world would not be deteriorating at the rate that it is, even though it doesn't have to. You know, sure, there are things that are unavoidable, but a lot of the stuff are of our own making, and we don't call each other on it. You know, it's like, oh, well, I can't discipline them. It's not my kid. Yeah, but you got to live in the same world as this little bastard. So it's like, you can't just, you know, brush him off and defuse the responsibility. I noticed that a lot in our communities, of the diffusion of responsibility. And we all do it. I've done it, you know, and you don't really know you're doing it until you catch yourself doing it. And you're like, whoa, I'm just completely deflecting that. That was my bad. That was me. I got to eat that. And it's sour and it's nasty. I can't even brush that out of my mouth. You know, you got to. We don't have enough of that. Right now it's too much, oh, it's their fault. it's the people on the right, and then the people on the right, it's the people on the left, and it's not enough. It's like, look, we know what the bullshit is. No one's calling each other on the real bullshit. Everyone just wants to use the regular, same old recycled talking points, and nothing ever really gets talked about, and nothing ever really gets fixed.
Well, but even though when we talk about stuff and where there seems to be a good movement, I'll give you an example. I put up a video about these guys for a nonprofit that are trying to raise awareness for this guy who's doing war crimes. His name is Joseph Kony, and he's a religious fundamentalist. And one of the reasons why I put it up, saying this guy goes around claiming he's the Holy Spirit. He basically abducts children, uses them as soldiers, and so on and so forth. And, you know, after I put it up, you know, even from the secular community, it's like, well, you know, they have these things. I don't necessarily trust what they're doing. And, you know, I felt like the reason I wanted to support these guys was, like, I don't know if I will always agree 100% of what someone, you know, says or does, but I can only go with what is effective, what's actually being moved forward. So maybe in a sense, like the problem that we have in terms of the right and the left is that you know, you can try to be part of the conversation and say, I'd like to just, you know, open the lines of the debate. But the problem is that we know that the makers, the movers and shakers, they're always on the extremes, and they pull at us from one way or the other. And sure, we can go around saying, like, I want to call bullshit, and I don't want to sort of like pick sides. But aren't we always put in a position, like even as non-believers, we're put in a side from our very existence? Like, how can we avoid this?
I mean, it really starts with education. And I believe education, not in the sense of, okay, we need to start in the schools. I mean, it's going to take someone really innovating the way we teach people. Like, we're going to have to force teach people. I hate to say it like that. They're going to be like, oh, you're a real socialist for that. You know, you're really trying to, you know, orchestrate society to your own. No, look, people are so dumb now, you might just have to start putting stuff up where you put signs up. You know, where there's freeway signs, where there's on-ramp stuff, you might have to actually put 2 + 2 = 4, you know, certain definitions of words. Because people, if they aren't forced into it, they will find a way to weasel out of learning what actually is. Because there's so much information out there that can support what bullshit they actually believe.
No, it's true. I mean, and there are a number of studies that sort of show that even for us, I mean, when you're reading someone's opinion that's contrary to your own, you're not really listening to what they are saying. You're already pre-assuming what you think is true, and you're interjecting from every sentence trying to combat what they're trying to tell you. I mean, I for one have always taken the opinion that you should know your opponent's arguments better than they know themselves. And I mean, like, if reading something contrary makes you uncomfortable, then I'm like, then it just sort of seems to reveal that perhaps you don't really have a lot of confidence in what it is you believe. Like, you should be able to read anything and just not feel like your whole world is going to get fucking rocked.
Right. And I kind of feel like you should take the kind of falsify approach. Like, if you, the first time you hear something that sounds like too good to be true, you should probably try to falsify that, because it probably is. And when you hear things that so support what you think so much, you're like, wait a minute, that can't be. But no one will take that next step and look up, okay, alternative viewpoints to this. Like, when I went through my agnostic period, I tried to reassert myself within the religion that I was losing. I was trying to find more information about it so it could falsify what I was reading from the secular perspective. There was none, or there wasn't enough for me to change what I had already, the position that I had come to.
Well, speaking of your position, can we go back and talk a little bit about this? Because I haven't heard anywhere or been able to read the history of your disbelief. Like, as far as I understand it, you're an atheist, but I mean, it sounded, at least from some of the lyrics of your song, that you used to be a believer, because I think in one song you mentioned that you missed the community element of it, if I'm not mistaken. But what are the specifics of your belief? Like, where did it come from? How did it erode? You know, what was that journey?
Well, because I grew up in group homes, I was exposed to a variety of different beliefs. One primary one being Seventh Day Adventist, and the other primary one being Episcopalian, which was two major religious group homes that I was in, where I served a big chunk of my young life. And it was those periods that, really had, the most fuel to burn when it came to indoctrination. I mean, because that was, I believe I was at my most vulnerable. I was just taken from my first foster home that I remembered. And the only thing I had to lean on was this alien environment and this spiritual community that you're handing to me. It wasn't that I sought them out. It was that they were handing it to me. Okay, well, if you feel lonely, come to church. Well, of course I feel lonely. I don't have a mother or father. So, yeah, it's easy, you know, to say, here, come to church. And so, you know, I assimilated it. I was a sponge. I soaked it up. For a good piece of my life, I really believed it. I really believed there was going to be an Armageddonist battle and, you know, all the things depicted in the Bible was going to be what they said
this
they
is,
were.
This is why I love Seventh-day Adventists. They are like the, they really are just, it's any day now.
it's just a straight literalist. I mean, that's how I, you know, that's what I thought. That's what the belief system in which, and then there was the Episcopalian side, which, you know, I was in this other group home that had that and, you know, I was doing sermons for that church, you know, on Christmases at 11 and shit, you know, like there was that particular belief system was so forced upon me that I was able to conduct sermons. They wanted me to do that.
At 11. It's like, what the fuck do you know about anything?
There are pictures out there somewhere of me giving a sermon at 11 at this church in Pasadena, California. I know it for sure.
Like, you're like pictures. The Black Marjo. Did you ever watch actually that documentary, by the way?
I did not.
You did not? It's free. It's on Google Videos. You should check it out. It actually won an Academy Award. It's about basically a kid preacher, Marjo. And he was like 5 or 6 when he's doing his sermons. He was like marrying people and shit like that. And the movie is actually the last year for his comeback tour. He got all these people to film it. And by then he's not really a believer, but he's saying like, you want to see how you get money out of fucking people? I'm doing this last show and just come with me and see what the fuck happens. So that, I think that's 1979. That was made. And, anyone who's ever heard kids preaching, mm-hmm. needs to definitely watch that, especially when he starts talking about the stories of how they used to make, like how his mom used to make sure that he'd remember stuff like weird cold water treatments and like just torture to get a kid to fucking learn. It's pretty mad.
That's crazy. I mean, I'm not, you know, when I was talking about forced learning, I don't believe you should torture somebody to force them to learn, but I believe that there are very subtle ways and subconscious ways you can educate the public. They do it all the time, you know, with advertisement. They've been educating us through advertisement and resetting our values and what we find important for as long as we've been alive.
Or what we find beautiful, just as another example.
What we find to be, you know, food, like, you know, McDonald's commercials programming people to crave Big Macs.
Well, you know, that you'll crave it and then your stomach will reject it.
Yeah,
it's like, definitely. Oh my God, I'm having the McDonald's tummy.
Out of your ass.
I don't know if you heard this story, but there was basically a few months ago, McDonald's launched this Twitter campaign, and it was called something about like McDonald's.
That can't be.
It was something like McDonald's stories. I'm not quite sure what the Twitter was, but the whole idea was basically they figured, oh, people are going to say, hey, I'm at McDonald's with my friends, right? Well, guess what the fucking what the internet would say when you have a tweet that says, here's my McDonald's stories. Oh, I ate your burger and I was shitting blood. McDonald's story.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you know, I should probably stop eating McDonald's.
Yeah, probably. But you know what? A lot of hatred, a lot of the conspiracy theories about McDonald's food, you know, even stuff that I probably at one time perpetuated, is just part of the reason why we're always distrustful of large corporations, just because, you know, why should we trust them? Have they given us any reason to trust them at all? It's like,
well, sure. They gave us the Big Mac.
That's true.
Aren't you satisfied?
Every time I eat one, definitely. I feel chemically satisfied.
Oh, man.
Such a thing
like
as possible.
Crack. It's like stomach crack, man.
Well, I
and then
suppose
so. On top of that, like if you can't cook, then you're really screwed.
Oh well, see, I'm lucky that way. I come from like a long line of cooks, and that was one of the things. Like when I was a young man, I just could not fucking get laid to save my life. So I figured the best thing for me to do.
Yeah, how to cook.
Is, yeah, not learn how to cook, be good at massages. Yeah, I learned a whole bunch of shit when I wasn't getting laid. I'm like, it was probably the best thing that can happen to a young man. If you want to develop talents, cut him off from sex entirely. Like, I spent 7 years without a girlfriend. I have a lot of talents as a consequence.
You might be right. However, I would not be one of the test subjects of that.
No, I
would
not. I don't recommend it. Let's just say it kind of fucks you up. It fucked me up for a little while. But yeah, hey, you know, the advantage is now, like, as an older man, I have talents and I have a beautiful wife to be. So I think that it worked out.
Can't be mad at that.
No, you can't be mad. Now, speaking of mad, this is one thing I wanted to talk about, and it's I think you know what I'm mentioning, because if you have a friend who listens to the show, you know that there is something I wanted to mention. This is an incident that happened a few years ago, and it's been dogging you in the atheist community because of, you know, like I've read a lot of comments about it. It basically involved you were formerly associated with the Rational Response Squad. And there was an incident while there that basically, I don't know the story specifically. I just know that it involved someone getting punched quite a bit, and that person doing the punching was you.
Right.
Now, I would love to hear, because specifically you mentioned the fact that you've had some time to grow up and some time to think about some of those actions. And I would love to sort of like have your, you know, your, for you to tell me, what the hell was that about?
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I still have a lot of, I still have and had at the time a lot of growing up to do. Now, this is not an excuse. What I'm about to say is not an excuse.
No. Well, I'm not asking you to excuse yourself in a sense.
But
no.
I would like people to consider my circumstances and the programming I received growing up on how to deal with problems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying what I did was right. I'm just saying I had a program already installed in my mind of how to deal with issues like that. And I didn't have any period up until that point where I had to deal with that without it actually happening. So I'm 25, 26 years old now, and this goes down. And of course, I'm thinking at the time, like, you know, obviously I felt wrong. I still feel wrong by what happened. I still feel like people, you know, don't know all the details. And the ones who do, you know, hey, you know what's up. But obviously I was dealing with that in a way that I probably shouldn't have dealt with it, simply based on the fact that I didn't have any other tools in my toolbox because I hadn't learned any other ways to deal with that. It was like, I caught you doing something real foul and shady. You know I caught you, and basically you're going to disrespect me after I caught you. You know, I'm not saying, like I said, it wasn't right. I'm not trying to excuse myself. I've committed, to me, far worse actions that I have to live with every day prior to being Graydon Square and after being Graydon Square. That, to me, you know, I'm not trying to minimize that, but puts it in the proper light. Yeah, I made a gross mistake, and if that continues to dog me within the secular community, that's something that I'm willing to accept because my decisions are my own.
Well,
but
yeah, no, I mean, the reason I say dog is obviously the person in question, Brian Sapient, which is not his real name. I don't know his real name. It was basically over, like, it was a some kind of business dispute from what I understand. And when, when I guess.
But that's not what it was over.
No.
I mean, no. To me, the business end of it could have been resolved from a business perspective. I just won't do business with you anymore.
Right.
That, to me, had to do with once I found out that the business wasn't, you know, the business end of it was sour, I confronted him in front of people, and he was grossly callous about it. I felt at the time, you know, disrespected where I came from. You know, that type of gross disrespect wasn't tolerated.
Right, right. So,
you know, and
that's what you're saying in terms
saying
of the program.
Right. And I'm not saying, look, it's right. I'm not saying that's how we should handle our problems. That's absolutely not the way we should handle problems, especially when it comes to business. I feel like I could have punished him from a business savvy perspective. Now that I know, you know, I could have done it much more strategic way. But see, I was still in young Compton mode. I'm still in young Eddie Collins gangbanger mode. Once that happened, it was like, you know, Graydon Square was a dream, something I wanted to be, you know, and this, you know, young kid with all this baggage was right there before you. And you're basically telling him that what he wants to be, you're going to stand in the way of.
So if I understand this correctly, like, I want to understand sort of the persona of Graydon Square, if you want. Is that the grown-up version of you, the artistic sort of like trying to evolve side of you that you just try
Absolutely.
To project out there? Like, do you ever feel that as though that identity is sometimes a bit, I don't know, ethereal, sometimes like, oh, no, I could just be back Eddie Collins any day now, or does it feel real?
I think you're right in that perspective where it's something that I want to be more than something that I am. You know, for a long time I was just Eddie, and you know, for an even longer time I went by a gang name. And if Graydon Square allows me to chase something that will allow me to escape all that and be something more than what I am and more than just a common thug, then, you know, I'm chasing it with everything that I have. Graydon Square is the idea that everyone, you know, can learn and become educated and informed through artistic expression. The way I educated myself was through art and expression and hip hop. And a lot of that, I feel like I can do the same for other people. If you want to learn about physics, I can teach you about physics. I can do it with music. And it's not just, you know, with music. It can be about life. It can be about why you don't want to join gangs. It can be about why you shouldn't just punch a dude for, you know, coming out of his mouth sideways on some dumb stuff. You know, like it can evolve and it can devolve.
And would you say like from, like, what happened after? Like, did you actually do time for that? Was there, what were the consequences of the
assault? Here's what happened. So, you know, I went to jail that night. I stayed in jail that whole weekend. The show, I think it was on a Saturday night. So I was in jail all day, all night Saturday night, all day Sunday, and then Monday all day until I got out. I had my court appearance and one of my other best friends and brothers was there. Brother Rafi was there, and he came from the courthouse, and they told me, because I was still in school, I was still going to school, and they told me, you know, you're to return to Arizona, but then you're supposed to return back to D.C. and face this, you know, this case, and it came, you know, like I was facing 2 to 4 years. You know, they were basically saying, you know, you're looking at 2 to 4 years, you know, you got a prior gang history, you know, and I was telling them, like, look, you know, obviously I made a mistake, but you know, this is 2 years and some change from combat, from, you know, being in Iraq. And so I told him, like, look, obviously I'm not right, but how else am I going to understand this? You throwing me in jail, and obviously this wasn't my argument. I basically was like, look, I'll do what you tell me to do. You know, obviously I want to make amends. I want to accept responsibility for my actions. But furthermore, you know, I wasn't trying to be in trouble with the law. I wasn't trying to be a thug. I wasn't trying to be, you know, I wasn't even trying to hurt Brian in that sense. But I understood when I felt disrespected, the actions that I took came with consequences. And those consequences were, you know, probation, you know, community service. I had to go to anger management. You know, I completed all that stuff. And I tried to basically move on and make my music. And I understood that when that incident happened, you know, it closed a lot of doors. It burned a lot of bridges for me for good, you know.
Well, it probably sets you back quite a bit in the atheist community in general. Because, I mean, I remember at the time when I was going back, like, it was all that people could talk about. I think, was it 2008 that it happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it, like, when you look at the timeline, it was a significant chunk of it. And of course, like, the thing about what I wanted to mention, just because, you know, obviously it happened. But I thought it was interesting, like, when we first talked, that you mentioned it yourself, like, some of my music, I don't necessarily agree with what I said at the time. Or I've since changed and I've grown up. Like, do you ever feel like, even with your art, because I feel like this all the time with the stuff that I draw, like I'm sometimes almost, I don't know if embarrassed is the correct word. Like I feel like every time I've said something or I've done something where I'm like, ugh, you know, I see the troubled line, or I'm like, that's imperfect, or I don't like the way that's crafted anymore. Or do you just sort of like, is there a sentimentality to the songs? Like, because I don't write music. I just know that I have no sentimentality for my artwork whatsoever. I usually throw it out. That's just who I am. But I mean, wow. It's like, I can't help it. Like every fucking,
just like, I can't get over the songs that I've lost in my life.
Oh, well, like the times where you were recording something and all of a sudden it's like, boom, it's gone kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, no. The original version of Starview is not that version. Starview sounded completely different. The only thing Starview had from that, let me tell you what happened with Starview. I had an NPC. I don't know if you can see my setup, but I had an NPC, and it had the original beat for Starview on there for 6 days. I didn't save it. I had a power outage after six days.
I felt that pain once in a while. You know, you record something, and you're just like, this is just going to be the most awesome, and you're like, oh, I didn't hit record.
Dude, it was, I remember thinking like, I can't even do it. Like, what can I do? It was one of the worst musical experiences of my life. And I've had a few of those. But I'm sorry, what was your question?
You know what, I completely fucking forgot the question, actually. After me having to emphasize.
You were saying something about being it was something about the period being sentimental. And here's the thing. I'm embarrassed at the fact that the mistakes that I made were because of the circumstances that I had growing up and not enough information to know that it would affect future events the way that it has. Because when you're living in LA and you're a group home kid, you don't think 4 years down the line. You're thinking 4 minutes down the line. You know, you're thinking 4 days down the line. You're not thinking 4 years down the line. 4 years is, you might not even make it 4 years. So it's not even a situation of, of that at all. This is me more obviously trying to understand myself, but, you know, trying to come to grips with the guilt that I carry from, you know, growing up, and the guilt that I carry from the military, and the guilt that I carry from, you know, the Brian Sapien thing. Of course, I'm sorry. That was my friend. You know, people fail to realize that we were friends. Me, Rook, Kelly, all of us, we were friends. We were all homies. And for that situation to go down like that, you know, obviously it shouldn't have went down like that. And the fact that it went down on such a public stage and all type of stuff, hell yeah, I'm embarrassed about it. And I'm extremely remorseful that people felt like in the atheist community, I was just some wild, crazed animal that was just running around beating people up. And then I had other baggage. People don't even understand. Like, I had so much baggage that came with me because of the circumstances of not really understanding what I was doing because of how I grew up.
Well, that's the hard thing for a person to empathize. I mean, I can try to understand through the lyrics of your music, but even I, fairly ignorant to, you know, the circumstances surrounding you growing up. I mean, I suppose in a sense, I mean, you said it before, you don't want that to be an excuse. But you're right in the sense that I think that we, you know, I can't really understand, you know, like the ghetto in Canada is not, you know, the scary ghettos in America, specifically L.A. during the 90s when black people were super scary. Do you remember that? Like,
it's all relative. It's all relative. The slums of Al Ramadi and Tikrit are, you know, people in L.A. or any slum in America should appreciate that they live in a land of opportunity wherein you could be an infrastructure that's crumbling around you in a civil war. I mean, you're not there. We still have this American privilege that it's the elephant in the room. All the problems that we have, you're still in America. You still can get up and go try to make something of yourself. Yeah, the system is pretty corrupt and people get over all the time and good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. But you're still in a land where you can get up and go do something. there are people in other countries that don't have that opportunity.
Definitely not. And do you feel like, you know, I'm trying to understand your musical career. Like, do you are you the one that basically are responsible for, like, your own albums? Do you produce them? Like, who do you work with? Like, what's your process?
Well, I am an independent artist, which means I guess I am ultimately responsible for my stuff coming out. And, you know, I guess my label is really just me. But to say that I'm ultimately responsible for what I've put out and what little success that I've achieved would be false and inaccurate. You know, it goes all the way back to, you know, you can't make beats on a piano. You know, you can play, but you can't record it. You can't synthesize it. You can't do something different with it. It started by asking, you know, my older brother, who had a little summer job working at a video store. He had a little money coming in, and I remember he had a family to take care of, and he didn't have any disposable income. And I asked him to buy me some $800 contraption, and he was the first one to tell me, you don't need $800 to do that. You can do that with software on a computer. And we went down to, I don't know if it was Radio Shack. I think it was Radio Shack. And we
bought, oh man, Radio Shack? Woo!
We bought this software called Music Center Pro, and it was $29.99. And that was my first studio setup. I had a little laptop that I got from the system where I turned 18 or something. They gave me a computer. And then he took, and I didn't have no money. You know, I had group home allowance, which was like $5 a week or something, $10 a week.
Oh,
you know, it was. That's what I was. That's what I mean.
Oh, that's
if
brutal.
If you didn't have a job, that's what you were doing. So if in the summer when I didn't have a job, that's what I was living off of. You know, not living because I'm sitting there in the group home, but, you know. But yeah, man, I mean, I think a lot of it is me trying to escape the past and trying to create a future that I don't feel guilty about, because, you know, I feel that a part of my problem is that I have so much guilt that it creates a self-sabotaging nature. If it wasn't Brian Sapien, it could have quite possibly been something else. I had a lot of, you know, stuff going on in my life and still do. And because of that, no, I still didn't have a proper way to deal with issues. So whenever that would have come up, I would have dealt with it the same way. If it's not Brian Sapien, it's just somebody else. So the problem was I didn't have no way to deal with that. And so the music was a way for me to just lay it all out there and say, hey, I know I'm a fuck up. I know I'm not perfect, and I know I make huge, horrible mistakes, but trust me when I say I'm sorry, and I'm trying to make the best of a situation that was a part of me and a part of my circumstances. And I take a lot of responsibility for just horrible decisions that I made in my life, whether it be directly or indirectly.
Well, I think that, I mean, we were talking about crafting identities, you know, and you mentioned the fact that you are in America and you have a little bit, you know, obviously you have the kind of opportunity that other people don't. And that kind of like makes me think about the title of your album in a way. Mm-hmm. Because the title itself comes from, correct me if I'm wrong here, because I'm sure it's a bastardization here, but it comes from this idea that to measure a civilization, you basically measure how much power it's able to generate. Because this can tell you, this one thing is the determining factor of any civilization. And I think to a certain degree, we can all agree that that's true. Right. And if I'm not mistaken, if I look at the cover, it looks a bit like a Dyson sphere or something. Like,
actually, it's a pretty unique interpretation of a Dyson sphere. It's supposed to be a structure where the star is its main power source. But essentially, the idea that we talked about was the Dyson sphere wouldn't be built first. Or I'm sorry, the Dyson sphere wouldn't be powered first. It would essentially have, the structure would have to be built and then powered from the inside. And that's what I told the artist to do. And he kind of, the first one he did was kind of like that, but it wasn't like that. It was kind of something built into a mountain. And then this one was more of a ship that kind of housed the sun. We basically wanted a structure that housed the sun. So,
like a ring world around the sun almost.
Yeah, basically. Real science fiction. You know, I'm a real Trekkie. I'm a super science fiction buff. And so, you know, anything that was going to depict anything Star Trek-like or Stargate-like, I was in it.
You know, I wonder if I at one point, maybe I should invite you on the show and we can have like one of those trivias to see like how good is your like nerd knowledge? Like, I'd love to know who in the atheist community is going to be the king of nerds.
Let me tell you something. I would win any Star Trek, Stargate, or
Star Trek.
I mean, I'm willing to put Sliders in that too. I know a lot about Sliders, Battlestar Galactica. You can't mess with me in no Battlestar. I'm willing to do trivia against anybody in the secular community, anybody really who think they can mess with me on some Star Trek. But, you know, as far as Stargate and Battlestar, I'm pretty solid on that, too.
Okay, we'll see with the Star Trek thing. Maybe we'll put the gloves down, you know, see who's king of the nerds when it comes to that. We should just totally have a contest. I think it'd be hilarious.
Yeah, it'd be great.
It's like, who has the greatest Star Trek knowledge? Because, I mean, I don't know if you do this, but I actually research the shows themselves, because one of the things I want to write after I finish doing the Bible stories is my book that I'm releasing is basically I want to write a book about Star Trek, because there's this one. I'll give you an example of what I wanted to write. Did you ever watch the episode Aquiel
from the original series?
No, from the Next Generation.
TNG. What season?
It would be season 6, I think.
Okay.
Well, here's what's funny about this particular one. This is why I want to write about it. Is that this is one of the worst episodes. Like, admittedly, from the writers and the directors, they hated this episode because they felt it's the one where Geordi finally gets a girl. Because I don't know if you ever watched Geordi, because he's always getting fucked over, right?
Yeah. And she hated him.
No. That's not the one. The one is where Geordi is actually supposed to, like, there's a girl who supposedly dies, and he's just doing a whole bunch of research on her, and then she comes back at some point, and then he has all this creepy knowledge about her, and then after that they sort of develop a relationship, but. Here's what's funny about that episode. The entire episode was written originally very differently, but the writer felt that it was too much, like, I believe it was the movie, was it Basic Instinct? Yes. They were afraid that it was too much like Basic Instinct. So instead, they changed the plot so that the movie is a total ripoff of The Thing. Like, what?
For some reason why I blocked that episode out. It must have been really bad.
It's a pretty bad episode. It's one where, like, there's this blob that's essentially like the dog is the bad guy by the end of it. And it looks like the blob from The Blob, done really poorly. Even the science fiction teams at the time were saying, like, we're embarrassed by this one.
Right.
Wash it under. And they even to add insult to injury, the race that Aquiel herself plays is so crappy that it's never mentioned again in any Star Trek episodes from that moment forward. That entire race is never represented again.
Wiped out.
It's so wiped
out. That's hilarious.
Exactly. So you ready to lay down the gloves? Because I'm king of the geek town.
Hey,
here.
You look like it. I recant my former statement about knowing every episode, seeing as how this terrible episode somehow escaped me.
There you go. Or here's the other thing, too, that you'd probably love. I'm indulging here because your audience hopefully enjoys this kind of thing. But the first season of Star Trek: The Next Generation is a very interesting thing to watch, especially if you know that many of the episodes were actually taken from other episodes that were supposed to be made for a continuation of the original series. So they took some of those stories and they just, I don't know, rewrote a couple parts, which is why the first season is so bad. But if you watch the first time they interact with the Ferengi, it's probably possibly the worst Star Trek episode. I mean, of all the Star Trek episodes. Especially.
It's funny, because I thought season 2 was worse. I thought Pulaski made a terrible situation. I mean, just unwatchable. Like, I literally, had I come into the series on season 2, I probably would have not even liked science fiction.
Yeah, it's true. She was such a fucking racist, you know, to Data. Like,
what?
Yeah, you never noticed that? She was so racist towards Data. Every episode, she just kept on saying how Data couldn't do stuff because he wasn't human and didn't have feelings. I'm like, you're racist.
Yeah, okay. You know, maybe she had a prejudice against androids. You know, maybe the androids in college didn't think she was all that hot or something.
I think she got rejected.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Data was a Mac. He got some of that Natasha Yar.
Yeah.
And so, no, he wasn't hating. So, and she looked way better than Pulaski. So, you know, you can't even Pulaski's. Don't even worry about it. That we go from season 1 to 3 without even breaking a sweat.
Well, season 3 is great. Like the difference between season 2 and season 3 is just feels like it's like a giant punch in the face. Like, what happened? But you know, my other favorite story of the Star Trek lore is that Patrick Stewart in the first season of Star Trek was so terrified that he was going to get fired that he did not unpack his bags for the first year. He just stayed in boxes. He's like, surely this is not going to work. They're going to fire me. Like, this is ridiculous.
It's nice, Patrick Stewart.
It's not. No, it's not that great. Yeah. I've been trying to work on it because, you know, when I shave my head and I put on a Star Trek uniform, I almost pull off a young Picard, but I can't do the accent. He's got, damn it, a Frenchman with a British accent. Go figure.
Yeah, that's tough. That's tough.
Makes a lot of sense. I love it. You know what it reminds me of?
What's that?
Do you ever watch Highlander?
Oh, my brother did. I hated that show.
Yeah, not the show. The movie that the show was based on.
I hated the movies, too. Oh. I think he's listening right now. If he's listening, I hated that. I hated Highlander. I never liked Highlander. It was never good. And then there was a third movie with a wrestler in it that was even worse. I'm done.
Look, anytime a person tells you that Highlander is good, I have a rebuttal, okay? Tell them this. How ridiculous is it that a Frenchman plays a Scotsman and a Scotsman plays a Spaniard? Enough said, right?
Yeah.
Enough said. Movie is ridiculous. Whoever cast this should be shot.
One other thing I'm going to suggest to you while we're on entertainment like this, before we get off of that, is do you ever watch a show called Spartacus?
Spartacus. No, well, you know, I watched the first episode, but I felt it was such a ripoff of Rome, and it wasn't as interesting that I was like, I don't know if I'm going to pay attention.
Damn, you should have kept watching.
Yeah?
The show's epic, man.
How many seasons are they at right now?
They're at three.
Three.
Because, you know, the main actor passed away. And they had to recast, and they did a mini series after that. It was really good. But all I'm going to say about that show is this. I'm a sci-fi nerd. It's about gladiators. It's the greatest show of all time.
You heard it from the mouth of Graydon Square. The greatest show of all time is
I mean, everybody in the in the room is blowing up. They're like, yo, Spartacus is the, you know, one person didn't watch it, but, you know, he's one person. But yeah, it's the greatest show of all time. I mean, you can't even, you know, I hear Walking Dead's pretty good. I caught a glimpse of that the other day. It did look pretty good.
Oh, I can't stand that show, man.
You don't like Walking Dead?
Oh,
like
no.
You don't like zombies? Well, stuck in a wall, barricaded with an M16 and 400 rounds?
Do you want me to tell you my opinion about the whole zombie craze? Because I'll tell you the long version if you want to hear it.
Give me the consolidated.
Okay. You probably heard about this, but there's this online training course that this one university is offering for, like, zombie survival.
Right.
We're so saturated with this bullshit that people are trying to cash in. That's all I ever fucking see is the cashing in on the whole zombie craze. I mean, I was done a long time ago. And when you're watching The Walking Dead, for me, The Walking Dead is poor because it's about 2 minutes of zombie stuff anyways, and 30 minutes of everyone going like, oh, the zombie world is so hard. How are you going to survive in the zombie world? And blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't care anymore. I hope that one of you just gets eaten or just, you know, everybody gets wiped out and you start with a whole new cast. Because why not, right? Like, hello, zombie fucking nightmare world. You'd have that kind of thing all the time. Everybody gets wiped out. That's how it happens.
That would be hot. That would actually be pretty dope. Just have, like, the last 6 days of each fucking group or something like that. And yeah, that'd be dope.
Well, I mean, in a nightmarish world like a zombie world, where apparently even when you're dead, you're semi-invincible. You can do whatever you want. Like, you break all the rules of entropy, I guess, when you're a zombie. So,
right.
Nothing can stop these magical creatures moving forward. And I always felt like, you know, okay, I understand that people have this obsession with zombies because it's supposed to reflect consumerism and part of our obsession with the macabre and so on and so forth. But I feel like in terms of, like, the zombie is not interesting. The zombie is not an interesting macabre character.
See, I've always been interested in the zombie, not for the zombie itself, but what the zombie horde forces you to do. It forces you to group up with your closest friends and family, as much ammunition as you can find, and as much supplies as you can, and it's your last stand. It's the epitome of the Alamo, but with the undead. You know what I mean? Like, you're just, it's me and you, and we're back to back, and we're going to run out of ammo.
Well, see, maybe that's, you probably played a lot of Left 4 Dead, I'm guessing.
I did play a little bit of that.
Yeah, probably. It sounds.
And it's zombies on Call of Duty too, as well. We play
zombies. Well, the Call of Duty zombie game, like I find, you know, after a while it kind of gets old. But at least Left 4 Dead, it's always different, right? Like you talk about back to back. It's like right. that's what everybody was playing it for. But I felt like at least by the time the second one came out, I'm telling you, man, I feel done with zombies. I'm ready for a new like creature. Like here's the other thing that, in regards to your album as well, like that whole Dyson sphere, right? Like the imagery that of the album itself. One of the things that I guess I keep thinking about, and I don't know if you think about this as well, is that in a world where people try to make up myths about what life should be like in science fiction, it's myth-making in the future. Here's what life should be like as we explore the stars, right? I don't know if that's fucking realistic. It probably isn't. But it's just that the myth-making is there. We identify a desire, and then we craft a legend to try to sort of, like, get there, right?
Well, yeah.
My question is sort of like, how do you think we as, because, you know, we don't have mythology the way they used to in other forms of thinking. How do we as rationalists, as people who you just look at science, how do we do that? How do we create those myths that inspire when sometimes the myths may break the laws of physics as we know, but maybe that's not a bad thing, you know?
Well, myths are a fragile thing because all it takes is a little bit of, you know, evidence and, you know, a lot of times they just vaporize. You know, myths are the ultimate vaporware. It's like it never really comes to fruition. It's always like, you know, whispers, hushes, never any evidence. It's always folklore. To me, it's almost like you kind of got to avoid the myth of self as well. Like, I kind of feel like we build up a myth about us, whether it be the individual, the city, specific race culture. There are a lot of internal myths that we carry around and we don't confront them. You know, it makes us feel bad. It makes us feel icky. It makes us feel, you know, depressed and down and hopeless. And to me, I don't necessarily know if creating, you know, myths is the answer. To me, you should always be on a search for truth and enlightenment. That enlightenment a lot of times it's not going to always make you feel good. It's not going to always make you feel yummy and fuzzy. You know, a true enlightenment is really tough, man, because you're looking at the most ugly of you a lot of times or the most ugly of someone else. And I kind of feel like if we're still in myth mode, then those things aren't truly exposed.
But could we argue that Battlestar Galactica, that Star Trek, these are myths? Like, do myths always have to carry this truth element to them? Because I feel like, you know, if you read, I don't know if I necessarily agree with her, but if you read Karen Armstrong's History of God, she seems to have this theory, and I mean, like to some degree, I'm partial to it, that in the old world, when you were talking about those stories, not everybody was always saying, "Is this what really happened?" Right, because I think that we kind of understood at a certain time that it's the telephone game, anyways. He said that, she said that, whatever said, right? But that by the end of it, what you're doing is you're putting a somewhat human face to something that is really not easy to understand. For me, myth making is about creating like a story involving something that you think is important or a way that people should be. You know, or way that people are and kind of expose those. When I refer to myth making, I'm not saying that we should create, you know, that this reality, this myth is true. But if we say we should explore the galaxy, when you look at, I mean, you studied physics, you obviously realize that that's pretty impossible. You know, given,
not impossible, just highly improbable.
Okay, that's why I said pretty. You know, the pretty is like, well, if I'm trying to look forward, you know, I'd love to talk to.
I love. Well, this is why I love, you know, alien conversations. When people talk about, you know, alien context and Roswell and how there's always aliens walking among us, and I always ask people, do you have any idea about the vastness of space at all?
And the boringness of space. How boring it is.
Most people's universe is no bigger than the solar system. And then some people's universe is as big as our galaxy. Some people understand. But few people are able to put in proper context. And no one really can. So, I mean, I'm being a little snobby myself. But few people can really put in the proper context the vastness of space that's ever increasing faster than the speed of light, powered by dark energy. You can't really fathom it. You just, everything else gets obliterated into nothingness or close to it. And so you're telling me that, so aliens came here in a silver ship and they landed in New Mexico in the last 50 years, 60 years? Right. I'll believe that.
Yeah, well, it's not just that. I mean, like, for me, I feel the ultimate challenge is not to, you know, whether or not life exists anywhere else, because I feel like to some degree that we should accept the fact that it does. It seems self-evident that it just does. But I feel like to some degree, you know, if we do just a raw statistics, kind of like the Drake equation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, you look at the Drake equation, you're like, well, the reason why we like it is just because it's just dealing with raw numbers. But some of those raw numbers, the hard numbers to really understand is that, for instance, our solar system is probably anywhere from a second to third generation star, right? Like the stars that came before that made the heavier elements that were necessary for us to actually be around happened long before our solar system was even around. And we do know that in terms of, you know, there's a lot of stellar nebulas that just don't end up being shit. I mean, what is it, like 3% of all fucking stellar nebulas become stars or something?
Right, they actually ignite, right.
Yeah, so the problem here that you have is you're like, okay, 13.5 billion years. Take your little fucking number thing, your Drake equation, and now you're saying that you have to be at least, we'll guess maybe second generation star, you're going to be okay. But I mean, the Earth itself and the solar system is 5 billion years old. That's over a third of the age. And you know that in the beginning of that, it's going to be shit. There's going to be nothing. There's going to be a whole bunch of extremely giant stars that later become the black holes that our galaxy center around.
My fantasies have always been about the earliest life in the universe. Like, what species could lay claim to the first intellectual species of the universe? The first of its kind. The first time. Because human beings can't be it. There's no way. I mean, just with the sheer amount of time.
No,
you mean
probably,
we were
probably.
Top up after 13.7?
No. It does. I would say, though, that probably you're dealing with impossible during the first probably few billion years, I would say. Right. You just don't have enough of the good stuff that you need. And besides, I think that also at the same time, I mean, we have to look at the you know, we recognize that for intelligence to come around, some stability seems to be somewhat necessary. And I think that you'll agree that if you look at the early universe, it seems like a pretty fucking chaotic place.
It was. The universe is still pretty chaotic, though. I mean, it's boring when you get out there in the vacuum, but if you're around anything that moves, it's pretty chaotic.
Well, did you
somewhere
see...
You know, well, go ahead.
Did you see any of the pictures? You probably, I don't know if you have my, you know, a good science feed, but they were showing, like, electron microscope for, like, a meteorite and how many just tiny, like, you know, sort of pot marks from, like, particles, minuscule particles traveling, like, thousands of kilometers an hour.
Right.
You're like, oh, man, space is dangerous. Space is so dangerous.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like it's the ultimate extreme environment. It's absolutely the most extreme environment there is to me.
I would recommend anybody who's never read Packing for Mars by Mary Roach. I strongly recommend. There's no better book to really describe how alien that environment is than that book. Like just talking about some weird things. Like, you know, there was footage of people taking a shit that NASA just got rid of. And it was important footage because the thing is, when you poo in outer space, it kind of twirls. It has a specific kind of way that it, you know, like you have to understand how poo behaves in space because human beings poo in space, right? But they were so embarrassed because of the Freedom of Information Act that anybody would see videos up close of astronaut assholes shitting out poo that they were like, we have to destroy this. But it's important scientific work. I'm like, someone's going to have to do that again now.
Yo, the chat room just blew up.
I'm guessing people are going to go try to read this book now, maybe?
Yo, somebody find me a video of somebody shitting in space, please.
That video doesn't exist. That's the problem. They all got erased.
Or someone has, like, mocked it or made, like, a mockumentary of, like, somebody taking a shit in space and swirling, like, straight 31 flavors.
Well,
style.
do you want to know, honestly, like, the real... the challenge that I have for anybody who has at least, I would say at least $300,000 is you can officially become the first person to ever have sex in space.
I would like that.
You know, like you can rent the Vomit Comet, and if you just fuck on there in zero G, you will officially, I'm not saying you are actually the first, but you will officially be the first person to fuck in like a zero gravity environment. Nobody's been doing this. Nobody's been experimenting with the fun stuff, you know?
That's $300,000 worth. What do you think?
Well, you become like, you will be fucking part of history at that point. You will be
Whatever move you do in space, they'll name it after you.
Fuck yeah, like a zero-G move that you couldn't pull off. Like, I would say anybody who's going to do it should think about it, you know, for a while.
Yeah. Only in space could you ever do that, so.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
The Vomit Comet. You just have, here's a couple things, though. You have to remember, I believe free fall is anywhere from, 15 to 30 seconds. I'm not quite sure. It's not long, so you better make sure that, you're warming yourself up there.
You say free fall?
Yeah, because the whole thing about the Vomit Comet is that it has to form a perfect parabola in order for you to get the zero-G effect. But as you can imagine, that means a lot of free-falling, and you can't free-fall for a very long time in a plane. So.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So the Vomit Comet is available to rent. I believe the price is somewhere around there, and you can become one of the first people, or the first official person to have sex in space. So it's out there. It's available.
Awesome.
Do you have any rich fans, by the way? Like somebody who could actually do this?
Rich fans. I probably do not. I'm sure all the rich people believe in a god because, you know, how else do they get to their money?
God, they seem to, and they're so good at basically funding shit. Like they always seem to manage that.
Rich fans, shit. If I had rich fans, you'd know it.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
I tell everybody, I'd be like, yo, son, I got this booster. I'd be the only rapper with a sugar daddy. He's paying for everything, dog. Everything. He's paying for everything.
It could happen. You know, you can't deny that. It could very well happen.
Look, Mitt Romney's got a sugar daddy. What's his name? Rick Santorum's got a sugar daddy. One dude just drops like $1 million, $2 million campaign funds. Like, shit, if they can do it, what's the difference?
Well, you know what the difference is. See, Mitt Romney already has a shitload of money, like $200 million of it. And he doesn't even.
When you're broke, they can give you money. When you're rich, they can give you money, but when you're broke, they can't give you money.
Well, let me tell you something. If you go to a bank and you show up there and they're like, and you say, I want money, they'll be like, do you have any money? And you'll say no, and they're like, well, you can't have any. And you're like, but I came here to get money. Well, you need money.
So if you go there with money, asking for money.
Oh yeah, you'll get money.
You'll get it.
I don't know. I wouldn't recommend every single way. Like there's certain ways that I would say that probably not. Like if you showed up with a briefcase with it and just sort of like and look real sketchy, they might not give you more money. They might just think that you're trying to launder it. But lots of actual companies have been caught laundering money for criminal organizations. So hey, you could be one of those lucky few.
Yeah, no thanks. No thanks.
So what are you working on anything new since you released the album? Like what's the next plan? Like
I'm retired. I'm just kidding. No, I'm working on the next album. It's called The Mandelbrot Set. The first album, The Kardashev Scale, was actually the full title of that album was called Type 1, The Kardashev Scale, because I wanted to use the scale system.
And saying that we're just at the crappy number one.
We're not even that. We're 0.6, 0.7.
Boo.
So, you know, the first single from the new album I put out called 0.7 is on my YouTube page. And basically, you know, it's even before we even get to one, is going to be, I think, the bridge between the Kardashev Scale and the Mandelbrot Set. And hopefully I can go so far down the rabbit hole with my lyrics that people just won't help but to say that, hey, this is a better piece of work than the Kardashev Scale. Or at least way, way deeper. Because what I want people to understand is the reason why I chose the name The Mandelbrot Set is because no matter how far you zoom into this, you can keep going. You can still keep learning. I'm putting so much information into this album that I don't even realize how much information I'm putting into this album. And that you will be able to look at this album and say, this wasn't just one person doing it. It was like there were a culmination of ideas and people's influences that came to create this album, as opposed to previous albums before it, where it was like me and my boy Trauma and my guy Doug and, you know, just close associates.
Well, I have not that I want to interject myself in what you do, but I've always been sort of like, obsessed with trying to find out what is the next way of trying to include people into bonus content? Because you were saying yourself, like, there's a lot that you're trying to fit here. But, you know, one of the things that I noticed, like, for instance, in your songs themselves, you don't include the lyrics in the lyrics section. Is that, like, sort of like a purposeful thing, or you just, is this not like a level that you're accustomed to sort of like
adding stuff? The thing is, I had no idea that I was going to be someone that people would even want to read the lyrics of.
Mm.
So early on, I didn't save. I mean, here's the thing. You know us nerds. We have old hard drives that don't make the move sometimes.
Right.
And some of my early Compton Effect lyrics were on a hard drive that didn't make the move. And so it was either type all that stuff out or just kind of wait and hope somebody maybe type them out for me. But recently, obviously, I've been typing out all my lyrics since the second album. So I have all my lyrics typed, you know, at least for the remainder of the albums that I write. So I'll always be able to have those lyrics. Now, putting them out, there's been two reasons why I didn't include the lyrics with the CD or the music. One, the cost. With CDs, a lot of times, you know, with my CDs, I only get the single inserts. And with the last one I got the double insert. Even that was like an extra like $2. So basically, if I was to add the 4 insert, even that wouldn't even include all my lyrics because I have songs that are like 160 bars plus. You know, I have almost 5 songs that are at least 100 plus bars.
Well, they are very lyrically dense. I will admit that.
So. And then that's what I'm going for. So, you know, I guess to find a middle ground somehow.
Well, is there a lot of your work that, you know, let's say somebody is listening to the show right now. They're either like a fan of your show or a fan of my show. And we told them right now saying like, hey, there's a bunch of songs where if you could just literally write down and we could have the lyrics. Because one of the things that I used to do, I don't do this anymore because I've been so fucking crazy busy, but I used to include all my notes in, you know, when you put the info in a song, like there's actually a section, lyrics, so that people who listen to it on iTunes can actually just see the info in the song itself. So there's like no cost to doing it. And obviously it's not very popular. I would say probably only like 3 or 4% of my fan base actually ended up using it. But the reason I put it in is because I knew that every show, when I talk about stuff, like, you know, we just finished talking about a whole bunch of books that I told everybody to read.
Right.
And there's probably some people at the end that are like, man, I wish I knew what the hell that book was. Right.
Right.
And this is where I think that we often find ourselves, you know, as content producers, we're not sure what we should include. I've been trying to sort of like look at this, and maybe we can compare notes, because I'd love to sort of like show you what I've been working on in terms of developing bonus content. Because, you know, like when I was listening to your lyrics and that kind of stuff, that's what I wanted. I'm like, man, you know, when he talks about you know, the scale itself or all these little bits of data that you interject, I'm like, there's so much more that's there, you know, like a link somewhere that a person could add to. I mean, maybe you're doing it for 30 or 40 people that end up using it, but I think it's pretty significant when you look at that, how much you're actually putting in, how much those people would get out of it.
Without giving too much of my future plans away, I will say this. I am currently working on a companion mobile application that covers all of my music.
Ooh, that's nice. See, now I'm jealous. Now I'm going to want that.
Right. And the good thing about this app is that it's not done. It's in the process now. But, you know, this app will come with the music already. So it's like you could buy the albums or you could buy this app for $20.
Nice.
And it has all my lyrics could be updated on the fly with new lyrics that I include and songs that I release through the app. So essentially, you're right. I have dropped the ball when it comes to having accessible lyrics. A part of that comes from not having a website. I dropped the ball on that. And then a part of that is not really seeing the importance of when people would want to research my lyrics like that.
Well, you know, you can't be that hard on yourself. I mean, the problem with being an artist today, I feel, is that you have to juggle so many balls. I mean, and the balls that you juggle, they don't stop, you know? Like, for instance, I went through a redesign for my site just a little while ago because I was having all kinds of problems with it. I came very close to quitting the show Which we're still in the middle of Save Good Atheist campaign, actually, so I don't even know if it will be saved. Because there's some significant barriers to that success. I mean, like, I am tapped out. I don't know if anybody knows this, but, you know, move back in with my mom with my fiance in tow is the height of embarrassment. You know, like, that's bad. It's fucking bad. Like,
yeah, but listen, you know, we all go through those times. Like, I moved back to Phoenix for a reason. Like, trust me on this one. Like, L.A. is expensive, but it ain't that expensive. And I feel like I should still be able to afford it. But, you know, it's kind of like, look, if I ain't got to pay that price, I don't have to. If you don't have to, if you can find a way to make it work, cut a little corners while you get back on your feet, there ain't nothing wrong with that, man.
No. But, I mean, I think it's more like, obviously, we can never deny, like, our egos when we do it. I mean, like, when you get damaged, when something embarrassing happens, when an incident that you'd just rather forget seems almost unforgettable, because that's what the internet's like. It doesn't fucking forget.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can, those kinds of barriers can be the ones where you just feel like, how many times am I just going to punch in the face? Like,
right.
It's like when your music got, you know, destroyed, that's a punch in the face. I mean, even success itself can sometimes be a punch in the face, where you're just like, other people are making demands on you, fucking, you know, can I keep up the momentum of what I've been trying to do, so on and so forth, you know?
And then you hear in the back of your, you have to wrestle with your own inner hater, you know, because there are times where I feel like, you know, the reason why I won't, you know, put out lyrics, I'll say something in my head like, well, they couldn't be that interested. You know, and people are, and I should give, you know, people more credit than I think I'm giving them, in the sense that, you know, I shouldn't withhold that when it's just a copy and a paste on a website.
Yeah, you know? It's tough to know, because, you know, there's a part, you know, of you that's always like, well, I have to have like a kind of standard of quality about my own stuff. And meanwhile, you're, you know, at the same time, you're not realizing, well, not everybody needs to have the most polished thing. You know, once in a while, you could just say, this is just something that I just was on my head, in my mind. I just wanted to put it out there. And a lot of times, you know, I fight that impulse, just because I'm like, who's really going to be interested? Like, I feel silly, like as if I'm just, you know, being egotistical. But the truth is, I mean, if a person likes your content, they're going to just generally like more content.
Right. Absolutely. So, I mean, essentially, that would be the idea to hopefully, you know, fix that issue, where I would have all my lyrics accessible in one place, and it would just kind of be like, okay, do you have the Graydon Square app? Okay, well, you know, that will help fix that. So, and I mean, I'm planning on a free version, too, just so that, you know, I could have just the lyrics and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's a work in progress, and I think, you know, in the near future, I'll have something that will remedy that not having lyrics available thing.
Well, it would definitely, I think, just add a lot more value, because I know that when I was listening and I was trying to take notes, but you go so fast, I'm like, I don't know, I'm not gonna quote verbatim any of the lyrics that I like, just because.
The good thing is I'm recording this on Ustream, so if you wanted to, you could just play it back on Ustream. So you can always do that.
Well, yeah, but now you're asking me to do just work. I don't like to do work. I think anybody who listens to my show knows that to some degree I fight this whole work. Oh, why can't everything be easy? Yeah, I don't like work. I like to just hang out, smoke weed, and play video games all day. Is that so wrong? Why can't I just do that all the time? So are you going to the Reason Rally? Are you going to be there?
I am going to be there. I'm going to support a good friend of mine who's performing at the rally, opening up for Bad Religion. His name is Tombstone. So we're going to go up there, me and the rest of Grand Unify. We're going to go up there and support the homie real hard. And then I have a show at the Reason Rally after party, which takes place just later on after all the Reason Rally stuff has ended, at a venue right down the way. Where basically, we're going to do it live. We're going to have an after party. A couple of my guys going to show up. We're going to do some songs, and I'm going to just rock it out, man. Like, I got new material I'm performing.
Nice.
This is the first stuff that people have heard. I got a song I'm doing called Ultra Combo. It's bananas. Metaphor Swordsman. I got a song called Prison Planet I'm doing. So I'm excited, because it's an opportunity to expose people to new music, and yet, you know, to interact with all of these like-minded secular minds, it's, hell yeah, I'm going to be there. There's no question.
Yeah, I envy you, dude. I envy you. I will not be attending.
Why not? I can't go, man.
I literally cannot afford it.
Oh, well, we got to start a get you there fund, man. If I can help start that fund and get people to contribute, I would do it, man, just to get you there.
Well, my whole issue though is kind of like, sure, I could do a fund, but if you're if you're having to say like, oh well, I get to, because you know this, every time you travel, you are bound to spend money. Like, it just happens. Like,
that's true.
And that's the thing that I fear the most, because it could just be like, hey, a person paid for your ticket. Be like, oh my god, traveling while poor. Oh, it's the most nightmarish thing in the world.
That's pretty bad. No, because if something happens, you kind of fend for yourself. You know?
I can't tell you how many times I just end up having to sleep outside for hours in the fucking cold. It's not exactly like this is the summertime, you know? And I would find myself in transit areas very, very, very cold. So I guess I'm just too, you know, maybe I'm a chicken shit. But the last time, here's my worst travel story happened, actually. This one time where I was basically at a crack rib, stuck in a terminal for 12 hours because I had to get the cheapest ticket possible. And I'm like, traveling poor sucks. So bad.
Yeah. No, that's like riding on a Greyhound.
And when you're 6'1", it's like buses are the worst. It's like,
dude, try being 6'4".
Oh, you're 6'4", bro.
Yeah.
Jesus.
I fly. Every time I fly, it's like a connection flight, and I got the middle seat. And people, like, literally will laugh when they see me getting in the middle seat because it's so hilarious. Like a clown getting into a mini car.
Well, at least you're not, like, 300 pounds or something. You know, like a big fat guy, too, at 6'4". Yeah, you'd be a real fucking joy to sit next to.
Yeah, nah, man, that would not work. I would, yeah, no, couldn't work.
Well, you know what? Maybe I'll do a how many days until the Reason Rally? How long is it?
17 days.
Oh, my God, 17 days. I don't even think I could actually afford getting back home. Like, it's pretty far. Like, it's Washington, D.C. I'm trying to think. I think it's, like, 17 hours from where I am or something. It's pretty far. I would love to go, though. Don't get me wrong. I mean, like, I feel like this year is my last year of really having to deal with shitty poverty, like... And you know, like, I didn't have, like, a solid product enough to survive. I mean, like, I know people love the podcast, but how many people fucking make a living selling podcasts? Really? Ricky Gervais?
I mean, does he get paid from podcasting?
Yeah, he's...
I know Joe Rogan does. I mean, and, shoot, if I could do my own podcast, I'd do it like him. Just, you know, invite people on there, get blazed, and interview them.
Fuck yeah.
It's like, what's wrong with that? He's got the life.
That sounds like a good time for everybody. But yeah, I mean, podcasting is still kind of one of those, you know, it's hard because it's not a physical thing. Like, I mean, I'm sure, like, you know, when you have a CD, if it was just all online and there wasn't anything physical, you know, it wouldn't be the same.
I agree with that because it wasn't the same with the CPT theorem. And I never really wanted to admit that. But it's true. I mean, I always felt like the CPT theorem is my favorite CD personally because it was a very trying time and all that stuff came out on the record. And, you know, but because it didn't have a physical CD, because it still doesn't have a physical CD, it does lose a bit of it because it's not something tangible. And I completely understand.
Well, the internet itself is a weird intangible thing. Like, think about this. Like, imagine your site or your music is along a toll road, like kind of like how it used to be, where people would just be on the road that everybody would travel through. Because, I mean, you know, you're a trader, you're trying to make a living, you got to go where the roads are. And we live in a world where there's a zillion roads. And in a sense, you can set up your very own road and set up a toll booth and be like, you can't pass through here unless you pay. Now, the problem is that it's like having a toll booth where in an area full of ghosts. You know, they just pass through. Right. There could be 10,000 people that go to your site and not one of them will come back. Not one of them.
And I guess if I'm going to completely tell on myself in this all-revealing interview, if you will, and I appreciate you giving me this couch forum to just vent.
No problem.
But, you know, I haven't had a consistent website in a long time. I started off having a website called thecomptoneffect.com, and then when I originally got gradeandsquare.com, some guy bought it when I lost it, like immediately. Like, you know, those things are on hold, and you don't buy it, they get on it, and it's got a waiting list. So I lost GradeSquare.com. And then so it was like, fuck it. You know, who cares? It's never really going to, that was my self-sabotaging nature. You know, it's never going to really happen anyway. So whatever. And then, when I started looking around, I was like, okay, I can do another website. I'm actually having this website built now that's hopefully going to combat that, that allow people to go to a uniform place or one location, a consolidated location, to be able to access my material.
Well, I will have to warn you, though, that those bastards are a lot of work.
Yeah, they are, man. And I always want all these extravagant things. Like, I want my site to look like a starship and, you know. So.
I want something sleek. I want. Oh, you should see. Like, I have this version that I designed because I do all the design for my site and stuff. And I had this version, and it's really sexy. I can't do it. So basically, what I had to do was just sort of take what I wanted to make, and then just sort of like find a theme that was very close, and then just sort of like work within my abilities. Because, you know, like I try to recommend this to anybody who ever tries to start their own thing, is like, at first you will have to do everything, so learn everything, and if you're waiting for somebody else to help you, like you're fucked.
What language?
Well, it's just WordPress. Like, well, with the CSS stuff, that's all I can do. CSS is my limit, dude. Just a couple of like aligning things, padding, I understand, being able to replace images and things like that, but really being able to, like, my little radio player, I don't know if you've been to the site recently, but my podcast player is one of those old school tapes. Like, I actually did a design of a tape player.
Oh yeah.
That took me 2 days to actually get working. So gives you a good idea of my skill level.
Gee, you say that, I guess a long time. That would have took me 2 weeks.
No, but I started like, okay, here's the thing, though. I mean, the internet is all about standing on the shoulders of giants, like, all the time.
Yeah, that all the time.
It's like, you don't redesign a site from scratch. You don't say, I'm going to invent a content management system. What are you, a fucking moron? Like, just get WordPress. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
WordPress, exactly.
But I mean,
bail out site design.
But I mean, like, for instance, with the player, I mean, there was... That player already existed because somebody had done a code for a much crappier looking one. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to take that, tell the coordinates to be different. So you're just playing around with it. It's very much like uncovering an ancient, sort of secret Sanskrit language or something like that, where you're just like, you don't quite get it. But you know that when you change stuff, it happens in real time. So you can break it apart. And I think that, I mean, like, that's the experience, I think, of any person who's not an expert in anything, who decides that this, like, the whole internet game they're going to play. I'm like, the first rule of the internet game is you do everything. So get ready to wear a zillion hats.
Yep, you're right. There's not one hat. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, it's not just one. And plus, like, I'm sure you probably have this problem too. And even when you're, you know, if your site becomes more popular and you're trying to promote, you'll find this where you're switching modes. Like, for instance, let's say you have a website problem, right? People's, I don't know, like your site's down, or it has whatever, 100 million different issues that could happen. But, you know, like, you've been dealing all day with this one issue, and then all of a sudden it's like, boom, you got to get, and you got to do something else. You know, you're committed to, say, doing your music, or you've got other shit to work on, and all of a sudden you're like, get ready to switch mode, bitch.
Right, right.
And you're like, I don't want to switch mode. So I just wanted to think about one thing all day, and you're like, no, put on your, like, little creative hat. Put on your little administrator hat. I think that's the part that most people have problems dealing with at first, is, like, switching from the roles. You're just like, one point you're like, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can fucking record a podcast.
I remember when I was, the first time I lived in Phoenix, I met this guy who had a studio, and he had a little label. And the girl who was responsible really for my atheism, she took me to see him, and he told me, seems like you're good at a bunch of things, but you're not great at one thing. Ever since he told me that, I've always kind of tried to be very narrow-minded on my focus. And so wearing different hats, multiple hats, while I may do it okay, I won't do it as well as focusing on one thing. I can accept that I can do it okay when I multitask, but I'm not nearly a good multitasker as I am a single-minded individual.
Well, but that's true for everybody. You know, like, the sad truth is, I think only really 3% of the population is actually multitaskers. Like, they can, you know, these are like people who can juggle and do other stuff, you know, like, it's not something that we're acclimatized to. And I think that's kind of like the unfortunate nature of what we do is really because our time is divided. I mean, ultimately, I always feel, because of that division, that the stuff that I produce is not as great as it could be. Like, I always feel like that. I have no choice. I mean, if somebody else was dealing with all the stuff, maybe I would feel like my work itself was always more focused. And you know, like, that's why I guess with you know, you wear so many hats, and I got to tell you, I mean, like, I really do like your music. And I don't say that very easily of most stuff. Like, I think most people will say that I'm not one to just sort of throw praise easily. But I felt like when I listened to your music, like, I'm not a big fan of hip-hop in general. Not because, well, I was the 80s version, but, you know. The 90s and 2000 kind of ruined it for me. But when listening to yours, like, it felt fresh because, I mean, I guess I never was really a fan because the lyrics never really spoke to me. You know, it didn't interest me at the time. And I, that's what I felt your music was really different because I'm like, I feel like that was the bridge that was missing. I wasn't being able to relate to, like, you know, the kind of hip hop that you're mostly listening to, the gangster.
But at least you didn't condemn the entire genre. I meet a lot of people, not meet, I guess. Meet would be a strong word. I read comment sections, which is, I guess, the next best thing to meeting people.
Is it now?
you know, I don't know. I sit at my desk a lot. But to be fair, like, in comment sections, you get a lot of people who, when you're talking about hip hop, it's, you know, everything negative, nothing positive. And we were talking about this, you know, earlier. You know, it never really gets credit for the positive things. Somebody told me yesterday that their daughter, who's like 10, knows the lyrics to Dopamine Kata. Like, I don't know what to say to that. Thank you doesn't suffice. You know, like, and then how does that coexists with me punching Brian Sapien or doing something else equally retarded.
Well, it does take away a lot of any kind of credibility, at least in the sense, though, that, I mean, when a person puts you in a position where you have to defend an entire, you know, art style based on, oh, there's this really obscene lyric that a 10-year-old can answer, I'm like, what the fuck, man? Talk about sandbagging me.
Right. And I mean, to me, I'm trying to find the medium there, somewhere trying to realize my musical dreams and at the same time trying not to become a victim of my own circumstance and of myself, because that's one thing that I have not truly acknowledged up until this point, up until this particular interview. And I thought a lot about this interview before I went in, and people were like, this isn't any more important than any other interview. And I completely disagree with that. Because I believe that this is a turning point in my life towards what I needed to be doing for the last 2.5 years, and I was not doing.
So what did you feel like? Why did you feel like this? You know, why did you decide to give me this honor? Why the Good Atheist? Like, why?
Well, a part of it's how you're viewed amongst my fan base. You know, people have always asked me, "Hey, how come you weren't on the Good Atheist?" You know, I'm like, hey, I don't know, but if you're interested in him that much, I should probably look him up and link up with him and maybe do something with him. And so it's really the fan base's esteem of you as opposed to my own, not to say that I don't have respect for you or anything like that. But really it was, you know, the people who cared about your podcast and in result looked at it as a way for me to speak to them. You know, and so it is more important this way as opposed to just a normal podcast where I'm answering just normal questions, because we didn't talk about normal things.
Yeah, well,
you asked me about anything and everything that was on the table, and I told you I'd answer.
Well, I'm glad that my whole approach. I mean, I at first I wasn't sure how it was going to go, because I like the information about you is really. It's not clear, you know, like I feel like the image of you is not quite there. But I mean, part of it is what you said before, where of course it's not, because it's still being formed, right? Like, who is great in square? That was what I wanted to know. And in a sense, the answer that I got is, this is a work in progress.
Absolutely.
And you know what, like, and I hope that everybody who just listens to it, because, you know, at the end of it, when I wanted to talk about that incident, because I felt like it was necessary for you to really fucking clear the air. I mean, like, the whole thing, I think the reason why people probably wanted us on this podcast is because I wasn't going to, you know, you weren't going to be able to bullshit me, right?
Right. And I think you were going to evade it anyway. You know, I felt like it was time that if somebody was going to ask me about it, you know, ask me about it, and I'll tell you whatever you want to know. So it wasn't like I was trying to shy from that. And it's not like I was going to. So.
Well, I'm glad that we also got to talk, like, before I brought it up. I really wanted to understand your history and where you come from, because although you admit it yourself, and I would never say that that's a defense to what a person could be like, I really feel like it's important for us to be able to empathize and really understand, because, I mean, ultimately, that's what you want to understand, too. I mean, like, why wasn't I able to fucking control myself? Like, why did I just let that get to me so much? Like, and this is probably the most important thing that anybody can ask themselves. I mean, I ask myself that question every time somebody hits a nerve. I'm like, if it hit a nerve, it meant that they told me something that I didn't want to hear.
Right. And it was also a part of why was I able to lose it there and not control it, and yet I was asked to lose it in other situations and have to do it and own that and be proud and praised for that, you know, because I did it to America's enemies.
Well, it's true that, you know, you said we were talking about just veterans in a way that people don't know how to deal with it. I mean, like, how are you supposed to deal with people who are professionally supposed to kill others? It's not very clear. There's a video game out there that actually apparently tries to deal with it. I have not tried it yet. I believe it's called Unbound, and it's basically a very simple game where you are a soldier who's a drone pilot. And your whole thing is that the part of your life that's piloting the drone pilot is actually an inconsequential part of your life. The rest of it is you dealing with a son that you're having a troubled relationship with, a wife who's just sort of, you know, like, trying to cope with the fact that you're away and there's tension.
So you're saying it's Shenmue, but for veterans?
Well, no, it's maybe not that complicated looking. It's very simple. I think it's just like an 8-bit game. But it's an RPG style, basically trying to deal with the whole experience of soldiers literally going to war and then coming back home the next day. Yeah. All the time, and like in perpetuity. I mean, like, that's one of those great unanswered things about the future of war. I mean, like, you went somewhere and you were away from people. And in a sense, you know, like the same way that who Great and Square is a bit of a, you know, like an amalgam, what you create. Like, the soldier version of you may have been in large part, you know, existed only because, you know, you were in the environment where that helped, where you were able to create a bit of that dissonance. But what about those guys that don't anymore? That they go home after they blew somebody up?
Right.
It's like, that's kind of fucked up. So
you ask them to go work a 40-hour, 50-hour, 60-hour work week.
Yeah, yeah. That's
tell them to just be proud that you were able to serve your country. I mean, it's a tough pill to swallow, and there are obviously worse case scenarios. But you know, that's a part of I think a veteran struggle and how you deal with that switch they turn on. They never turn off, man. They never turn that off. And you have to walk around with that. And, you know.
You think, does it get better all the time? Like, do you just feel like every day you're a little bit wiser, a little bit, like, more grown up? Or is there some times where you feel like you've regressed? Or, like, how does it go?
I mean, honestly, there is one thing. I've had the same dream. Probably, even when I don't remember it, I kind of know that I have it. There are, like, remnants of it. And it's basically, I think, my mind trying to tell me that I'm running away from something that I haven't completely dealt with yet. And it has a lot to do with, you know, Iraq. It has a lot to do with group homes. It has a lot to do with, you know, getting locked up. And you know, for me, like I said, it really comes back to music. Like, if I don't have that, I become toxic. You know, I start to question, you know, what it means, if it means anything, what I'm doing here. So, I mean, I don't know if there's a direct answer to your question, but, you know, I know that I want to be better and that I want my music to be a reflection of the journey that I've made from then to now and where I'd like to be. So.
Well, you know, I think that's probably a pretty good way to end the interview, dude. We've been I could probably do this all day, but I feel like what we should probably do is is there any going to be any way where the stuff that you're doing for the post party, is that going to get filmed in any way? Like, are we actually going to get to see any of that?
Well, I was going to stream it on my Ustream, and then I was going to record it off my Ustream, but I know there are supposed to be some film. You know what? Let me verify that, because I don't want to give you any information that's been solidified yet, but we are working towards making sure that we have documentation and assets of the performance. Yeah.
Well, because what I'd like to do is maybe we can do a bit of a follow up in a few months. Because like you said before, I mean, you said that part of this interview was like, I'm trying to, I don't want to say reimagine myself, because that's not a fair way of saying it either. It's just like coming to grips with things, having like that positive attitude, and just dealing with the ugliness of the past.
Right. Know? And I'm trying to take responsibility, I think, for my actions, in which maybe I showed myself as being a bit callous and not really caring about the way that I was perceived. I do not want to be perceived as someone who is overly aggressive and violent, even though I have a history that's contrary. And so if I can work towards that to change that perception of me because of the decisions that I've made in my life, then I'm willing to do that. And it's not something within the secular community. It's not something within music. This is something within Eddie Collins. Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with just being great and square or wanting to succeed or, you know, that stuff comes later. But, you know, for me, yeah, it's definitely more.
Well, we look forward to your music, dude. I'm very anxious to see what this new stuff you got cooking up. Like you said before, I mean, Are you in a good place? Like are the lyrics flowing?
Dude, I got, all right. So I'll just be honest with you. After the recording, I'll let you hear a song that I got. Because I'll do it for the room. It's called Ultra Combo. I'm telling you, man. This album's gonna be nuts.
Well, can I put that like after the interview? Am I gonna be able to put some of that music in the podcast, because I'd love to finish the podcast up with one of these songs, if that's possible.
Well, I'll give you a snippet of it when I'm done recording it.
Okay.
Right now.
Yeah.
Not recorded. That's why I'm actually getting ready to do a live version of version for you in a few seconds.
Okay. So what you're telling me is like, be patient, and I'm going to just show you some shit.
I could, I would. I don't even have that asset for you right now.
Fuck.
Yeah.
That's too bad. You know what the problem was? You were so busy being apparently nervous all day that you weren't ready. No, I'm just joking.
But to be honest with you, that was a part of it. That was a part of it.
Well, it's not so much. Well, here's the thing. I mean, it wasn't nerves because of talking to me. It was just nerves because, I mean, who knows what we're going to talk about?
Yeah, but I knew. I knew everything and anything.
You did? Oh, my God. Like, you read my mind, dude?
Yep. Is that it? Yep. Straight Deanna Troi style.
No, I mean, not Deanna.
And I gotta, you know, like have a wedding naked or something like that. Reading minds just comes with the territory.
Deanna Troi, the woman who says what everyone else already knows. Oh, the red alert? The ship is scared. Is that right? Thank you so much for your fucking input.
But yeah.
You know what? Actually, that reminds me. The last thing I want to say before we go, because I mean, I'm sure you're going to get a kick out of this. If no one has ever seen the movie Species, go back and rewatch it. It's probably the worst role that Forrest Whitaker has ever been in, and it's the worst role.
I remember that movie. I don't remember that movie being that bad.
Yeah, because you probably watched it before you were really a skeptic. You want to know why? Because when you watch Forrest Whitaker, because you know what his character is in the movie?
Yeah.
He's a psychic. He's there to tell you what happened. He has no purpose there but to walk into a room that's full of blood and saying, people were really scared in here. There was a lot of violence.
That's right. That's right. I remember that. But I still don't remember that movie actually being as bad. I remember thinking the idea of this chick force mating all these dudes. And that was the first one.
That was the first one. That was
First one was the guy, right? The guy, he went to Mars, comes back.
No. Wait. It's the one he goes to Mars? Yeah, does he go to Mars?
They went to Mars. That mission, they went to Mars, he comes back. He's the son of like a senator or something. And he comes back, he starts feeling weird. Then he goes to that hotel. He got kills the hooker by like he impregnates her and the alien jumps out of her stomach. You know the movie. I'm killing it for everybody.
You are killing it for everybody. All I'm saying though is that as a skeptic, you know, this is one of those classic movies to watch to just see how silly psychics are. It's just the whole time you're thinking like, Forrest Whitaker, go away. Like you're not even necessary. Oh, you walk into a room full of blood and you say that something terrible happened. Oh,
you're okay. A black fat Deanna Troi, and it's not working.
Totally. And I mean, I love Forrest Whitaker. It is as far as I'm concerned, the worst role he's ever had. Like worst. Best one, Ghost Dog. Worst one, Species. Yep.
Yeah.
Worst movie ever. So next time we do the show, you know what you and I are going to do? We're going to do contest.
Trek trivia?
Trek trivia, dude. We're going to do a live broadcast Trek trivia. We're going to get people that are going to come on, and they're going to ask us trivia questions. We're not going to be allowed to, like, look on the computer, and then we're going to see who's the champion. And I expect you to train, dude.
I am. Please. I will throw – I got all of them on digital. I got the whole D-Space 9, Next Generation, Voyager – TOS, the animated series, I got them all. I got the whole digital catalog, so I will be putting in mad work for that. Good. I won't lose. I'm telling you now. I won't lose.
All right. I'm taking up that challenge.
All right.
Yeah, you're going down.
You guys heard it. I've been challenged to Trek trivia. I don't appreciate it. He's challenging my fandom. I got to respond.
Yeah, well, you know, you were saying that you're in defense of Nerdcore. I'm going to test your Nerdcore, pal.
Right. All right.
Sounds good. All right, thanks for such a great interview, man. And I'm sure that we've got nothing but awesome things to look forward to, dude.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
No problem. Let's do this again real soon.
All right.
Peace out.
Peace.